Overnight came news of a crash of a firefighting aircraft in New South Wales, Australia. Three Americans were on board. There were no survivors, but details are limited. On Insight, the U.S. Forest Service has canceled our planned conversation with the Director of Fire and Aviation Management, but we will bring you the latest information that we've been able to gather. In the midst, meanwhile, of investigations into the deaths of horses at Santa Anita Park, three more horses died in the past week. State government reporter Scott Rod will detail the legislature's involvement in this. That's in this week's Capital Chat. And we continue our conversations about women's activism and the long journey to gaining the right to vote. Historian Joanna Newman will join me. She traces the efforts by American women in a new book titled And Yet They Persisted. Dr. Newman and I will continue this conversation in an event open to the public tomorrow at Sac State. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Cap Radio will again today bring you NPR's gavel-to-gavel coverage of the impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. That coverage begins at 10 a.m. On days when Insight is preempted, you can find our show and our podcast at capradio.org/insight. So let's shift now to the firefight in Australia. Overnight, we heard news that a Lockheed C-130 carrying a load of retardant in the New South Wales area crashed. There were no survivors, though three Americans were reported to be on board. Here's a bit of Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons' press conference. He is with the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, and this press conference was held shortly after the crash.
Tragically, there appears to be no survivors as a result of the crash. Down in the snowy Monaro area. It's impacted heavily with the ground, and initial reports are that there was a large fireball associated with the impact of the plane as it hit the ground.
We had planned, as you might know, to talk with Shauna LaGarza today. She is Director of Fire and Aviation Management for the U.S. Forest Service. She had just returned to the U.S. from Australia. The U.S. Forest Service, understandably, canceled the conversation after the crash today. There are some connections to Northern California, however. It has been reported that the plane that crashed had been one used in California in firefighting last summer. And in fact, CAL FIRE's aircraft includes seven C-130s, though this one in particular was from Coulson Aviation. And the USA office of Coulson, which is in Portland, Oregon, did report via Facebook a message saying, and I'll read the message, while working in the snowy Monaro area in southern New South Wales, Australia, contact was lost with one of our large air tankers, a Lockheed C-130, and then the registration number. The aircraft had departed Richmond, New South Wales, with a load of retardant and was on a firebombing mission. The accident is reported to be extensive. We are deeply saddened to confirm that there were three fatalities. It goes on to say the accident response team has been activated, as well as local emergency services, and Coulson Aviation itself will be sending a team to the site to assist in emergency operations. We have been on standby to talk with CAL FIRE's Deputy Director, Chief Mike Moeller. So I do think we have him on the line right now. Chief, glad to have you on Insight.
Beth, as always, thank you for having us.
Are there any other details you can add to what we know right now about the crash specifically?
There's not. And like you have previously mentioned, you know, it's really about the Coulson Aviation, but the family of the firefighters that were tragically lost in that horrible crash and tragedy in Australia. Again, our department's thoughts and prayers are with both the family and Coulson Aviation, who has a very strong tie to California as a contractor for aircraft.
It has been confirmed from Australia that the three people on board were Americans. I'd like you to confirm that independently for us, as well as this detail about the plane that crashed having been a plane that was used in California last year.
Well, yes, as far as we know, and again, this is obviously the Australia is working very closely with Coulson. This is a very advanced aviation company that has worked in fire arena for years, but we can confirm, and it's unfortunately, that they are from the United States. What we're looking at is that C-130 Hercules is an aircraft that has been used in California to battle wildfires for the past several years, and it actually has been flown out of here locally, out of McClellan, several times for reload operations.
How many C-130s does CAL FIRE have and use?
Well, currently we have seven C-130s that were acquired through the Federal Defense Act that we're working with Governor Newsom's administration to, with our military partners, to convert them over to aviation fire operations. The Colson, we actually have one on contract during our peak, or what we would consider our busiest time of the year, to assist in not only fire operations, but also to get our pilots trained up with our cooperators at DynCorp. So that C-130 was dedicated to CAL FIRE through the peak months of what we saw passed in 2019 and 2018.
Talk to me in whatever detail you know, Chief Mueller, about operating the C-130 in the midst of the firefight. I said that this was the snowy Monaro area. That doesn't mean literally there was snow on the ground. It's called snowy Monaro with two capital letters. But what was happening in the area was extremely high wind. Of course, there are more than 80 fires burning in this New South Wales area and reportedly more than 70 aircraft involved in the firefight. So say more about what the conditions might have been.
Again, we don't have all the details, and we know that there was high winds in the area. But what we have to remember, and for your listeners, is unfortunately here in California, we're not foreign to wildfires. We see aircraft, the public sees aircraft assigned to fires. One of the most dangerous jobs in the world, one of the most skilled positions in the overall firefight. But it is very dangerous. The C-130 platform provides a what we consider a large air tanker, what we would use for, 4,000 gallons of retardant. So it's a large aircraft. But anytime you take those aircraft and you put them into fire conditions, everything has changed. And these pilots, again, are some of the most skilled, but it is one of the most dangerous jobs you can have. And we will continue to work with Colson, but also the C-130 program, because it is absolutely necessary and is definitely an advancement in fire aviation.
So news had just come that three 10-person incident management teams, plus air support personnel, and two 20-person firefighting crews, hand crews, were all engaged in the movement to Australia. You and I talked about this over the last couple of weeks. Has CAL FIRE in any way been engaged beyond the U.S. Forest Service in sending support to Australia?
We have not. Again, as you well know, we've talked several times about our relationship with our partners from Australia. Unfortunately, we have similar climate and similar fire conditions, so we have worked with them, and we've worked with the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, who's brought Australian counterparts over during some of our largest fires to train. CAL FIRE isn't directly involved overseas, but we are supporting our federal partners, and again, supporting Governor Newsom and his administration to be ready to respond if asked.
Chief Mueller, in a news release that came from the National Interagency Fire Center just yesterday, the detail was that the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand have been exchanging fire assistance for more than 15 years. I'm sure I'm not the only one that didn't know that the relationship has gone this long and as deeply. And if you could just say something about 2018, when apparently there was a contingent of Australian and New Zealand wildfire personnel that came for the car fire, it must have been?
No, absolutely. In fact, I think, Beth, you and I had talked about it, why they were in country in 2018. I think the large portion of the story is that what we're seeing in California as far as wildfires and the increase in size and severity, it's not just here in California problem. This isn't really an international problem. We're seeing across the globe. And those are where those relationships are forged, out of cooperation, not only within country, but out of country, where we're all coming together. But they were here at some of our largest wildland and most destructive to assist. And then also, it's really about learning from each other and how our countries operate. We can only gain by working together.
So that would have been the car fire and the camp fire in 2018. And to pick up on what you just said, learning from each other, how matched is what you know about the firefighting in the air beyond just the fact that there are some of the same planes, the C-130? How do they manage their air battles compared to what you've done, what CAL FIRE has done here in California?
Well, very similar operation as far as command and control with our, our overhead, what we consider here in the States our air attack officer, which is really the air traffic control tower airborne, working with the ground troops to coordinate airdrops. But it's very similar, the safety precautions and the what we would consider a no-go checklist. Either we're going to put aircraft up, or are we looking at smoky conditions? Are there reasons why we don't put it up? Ground safety. But again, Australia is very well versed in these type of operations, very similar to what we see here in California. So it's seamless. And again, every time we work with Australia and their professionals, we gain tactics, strategy, but also building that relationship.
We're talking about the fires, but if you've looked at any headlines from Australia, you know that extreme weather is now hitting Australia and is adding to the devastating circumstances. There has been heavy rain, which is causing flooding. There have been high winds, heavy hail. In the mix of all the weather and the fire, what do you know about the strategy going forward, Chief Moeller, in how this extensive group of fires right now is eventually put out?
Well, again, if we look at what we saw, from 2017 into 2018, almost mirrored what we see here in California. We have these massive wildfires, destruction, not only what we consider wildland urban interface, but our watershed, the vegetation that really holds up our hillsides, as we saw in 2017 after the Thomas Fire, the unfortunate debris flow and mudslide in Montecito. We have what we consider or what we call watershed emergency response teams to go and look at these areas where the vegetation's really been denuded from these areas because of the intensity of the fire. Well, Australia saw the exact same thing with, massive large wildfires, over almost 20 million acres. But as far as the storm that came in with the hail, they also had to switch tactics operations to the debris flows. And then, again, evacuating people not from the fire, but now from the water and the runoff from what we consider the watershed area because all the vegetation is gone. So, again, it's a year-round issue. It's not, smoke out of the sky and we're safe. It's about the planning behind it. After these wildfires go through communities.
All right, Chief Moeller, anything else to say about the circumstances that everybody now finds themselves in? A crash that happened overnight, an investigation, three Americans who were on board apparently killed, and the raging firefighter battle that continues along with the weather. Any other perspective to leave us with?
I would just say, and again, Beth, you've worked for CAL FIRE for years, and unfortunately, these conversations, we're seeing it, we live it, and Australia is living it. But it's really for us as a fire agency and first responders, it's about supporting each other, but it's also supporting the families of loved ones that have tragically lost their lives battling these type of incidents. But really, it comes down to the fire survivors is working with our communities, standing those families back up. And looking to the future on how we're going to move forward as these conditions aren't going to change, and we will continue to work with our partners in Australia to advance in firefighting operations. But again, this is about the pilot, his family, and the unfortunate loss.
And in fact, the Colson family of Colson Aviation ends its Facebook post with these lines: "Our thoughts and prayers are with the families of the three crew members on board." Chief Moeller, thanks as always for your information.
Thank you, Beth.
That is CAL FIRE's Deputy Director, Chief Mike Moeller. And to repeat the news, if you're just joining us, a firefighting aircraft, a C-130 Hercules, working in the area of New South Wales in Australia, crashed in the last 24 hours. Three Americans were on board. There were no survivors. Details at this point have been quite limited. This was, as you heard Chief Moeller confirm, the same type of plane, if not specifically the exact plane, that was used in California firefights last year. We will continue to update this story throughout the day at capradio.org. And coverage of the impeachment trial will begin immediately after Insight today at 10 a.m. Up next, I'll talk with CAP Radio reporter Scott Rodd about the ongoing tragedies at Santa Anita Park. That's in this week's Capital Chat, and you are listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. In 3 days in the last week at Santa Anita Park, three horses died. The park is a thoroughbred racetrack in Arcadia, California, which is just outside of Los Angeles. And these deaths extend a growing history of horse deaths at the park. The races, however, still continue. The story tops this week's Capital Chat, and State Government reporter Scott Rodd is joining me. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Beth.
Let's talk a bit about that history. Take us back in time and give me some numbers.
Well, going back to last year, there were 37 fatalities. And that was something that raised alarms for a lot of people, both advocates and lawmakers. And in years previous to that, there were actually higher numbers of deaths. But last year was one that really caused people to start to take a look at it. This year, since December, there have been five deaths. That's about on pace with what it was last year. And considering that there was a lot of activity on this front, lawmakers passing legislation, advocates calling for reforms, the California Horse Racing Board passing regulations. The fact that they're on pace with last year, there are some concerns there about, well, how much progress is being made.
So to total the numbers then, are we looking at 42 overall since December of 2018, if you add the five more?
Yeah. So from December of 2018, the start of the 2019 season, I should say, there have been 42 deaths. Yeah.
The death on Sunday, though, was made news headlines because of this detail, a collision. And that's different from some of the others. What happened?
It was this kind of freak accident, yeah, during training where two horses collided. And in terms of horse fatalities, that's pretty rare. It's this accident that you just don't typically see. So people saw that, advocates and lawmakers saw that and said, okay, that's not the typical sort of fatality that we've been seeing. So, you know, there was, I wouldn't say less scrutiny. It's always devastating when a horse dies on a track, but it wasn't similar to the other deaths, which were typically breakdowns during races or during training. And a breakdown is when a horse has some sort of injury, typically a leg injury, that they won't be able to recover from.
In terms of oversight, there's the California Horse Racing Board, and there's the California Legislature, and I'm sure there are a number of other groups and agencies involved. But with those two, what's happening with regulation and investigation?
So the California Horse Racing Board is this pretty small department in state government. I mean, if you look at the map of California state government, which is very big, the official map of that the state releases, it's all the way down at the very, very bottom in terms of size. So it's a small agency, but they have been under the spotlight for the last couple of years for this reason. So what the California Horse Racing Board has done is passed a number of regulations that change what sort of medications horses can get. They've changed how veterinarians can view records, and they've also passed some regulations about ensuring that there's more transparency when there is a fatality, making sure that those records become available. In terms of the legislature, there was a law passed last year that allows the Horse Racing Board to suspend racing at a track if they feel that the conditions are unsafe. And then this year, there's pushes for more reforms, more transparency as well. And, you know, so you're seeing these changes happen. I should also say that there are efforts to, this doesn't exactly address the fatality issue, but it's in line with this idea of trying to make the sport, I guess you could say, more palatable for a 21st century audience. They've done things such as pass a, or considering a ban on the riding crop. So they've done away with the traditional whip. It's now a crop that doesn't injure the horse, doesn't hurt them at all. It just kind of sends them a signal. But they're even considering banning that just because the optics of it look bad if you're hitting a horse with anything. And they've also considered things like, I reported on this last year, being one of the first states to have a concussion protocol for right. jockeys. And so those don't directly address this horse fatality issue, but there seems to be this growing effort to try to make the sport, I guess you could say, more humane or more palatable for a 21st century audience.
Is there pressure or growing pressure to close the park altogether? And what's happening right now with the races that are happening today and over the next couple days and weeks?
There is pressure, I would say, mostly from advocates, you know, such as, you know, PETA is probably the leading voice on that front. Lawmakers, there really hasn't been much appetite expressed for, you know, an all-out ban or anything or shutting down the park. There have been calls for, you know, investigations, reforms, but there hasn't been really calls from lawmakers to ban it. However, Governor Gavin Newsom, in an interview last year, you know, he signaled that he felt the sport had to evolve, had to change in order to survive. So he kind of signaled that, you know, the status quo in horse racing, that's not going to be able to persist if the sport is going to survive. On the flip side of that, horse racing is a very traditional, it's a sport that's very much rooted in tradition. They, people who follow horse racing, who work in horse racing, you know, they value sort of the tradition that horse racing comes from. So for a lot of them, swallowing some of these changes, some are easier than others, but they're a bit more, I guess, averse to seeing some of these changes in the sport.
As you said, you've been working on some of these stories, but the numbers have changed and the investigations into why some of these deaths occurred is ongoing. But in comparison to tracks across the country, do you know where Santa Anita Park is? And it's kind of strange to say X number of deaths is typical or on some sort of standard, and I just like more context.
I don't have a sort of a national perspective on it. I can say that it is, you know, in horse racing, horses, you know, during races, you know, unfortunately will die. I mean, they're typically, it's not very often, it's actually quite infrequent. So, you know, and people in horse racing will say, you know, this is an unfortunate reality of the sport, but these horses are very well taken care of, probably as, you know, well taken care of as horses as you can find. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of the numbers, it's hard to say, but it's certainly clear that the dozens of fatalities that have happened at Santa Anita Park over the course of the last year or so, that's raised alarms. That's certainly higher than both, I would say, what is typical and also what the public and lawmakers are willing to accept. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Scott Rodd in this week's Capital Chat. The reporting on the situation at Santa Anita Park will continue, and you can find some of the past reporting at capradio.org. Since you're here, let's cover a few more topics, Scott. Uber is piloting a new pricing program. Would you explain?
Sure. So it's being piloted at three airport locations in California, Sacramento, Palm Springs, and Santa Barbara. And it allows drivers to increase their fares on their own. So they can raise it in 10% increments above the standard base rate that Uber sets. And they can raise it to 5 times the base rate. That's quite high. From drivers that I spoke to, it sounds like that wouldn't be used, that high of a rate wouldn't be used unless it's extraordinary circumstances. But they're allowing these drivers to have more control and more flexibility in terms of how they decide to operate.
So if you get on the app and you're going to book your Uber ride, you do see the fare. You don't know it in comparison to other drivers. You just know what that fare is. Is the ability to move fares around in context with the volume of cars or an event, a particular time? Are there any other criteria?
Sure. So if a driver decides to raise their rate above that sort of standard base rate, the app will connect a rider with the lowest available price. So if everyone decides, you know, we're going to raise our rates a little bit, but there's that one driver who sticks with the base rate, that one rider will be connected with the person with the base rate. And so the idea is that you can raise your rates a little bit, especially if you feel like there's really high demand. A driver might end up waiting a little bit longer to get that connection. But as far as the rider's concerned, they're really none the wiser in terms of their interface. They're when they look at the app, they don't see anything different. They're not clued into if, you know, this is a slightly higher fare. They might notice it if it's significantly higher. They might say, oh, wow, I'm used to a $10 fare, not a $15 fare. Mm-hmm. But the difference won't be very significant. And I was able to get out to Sacramento International yesterday. There's this little parking lot where all the Uber and Lyft drivers wait. And I spoke to a couple of drivers. This is a very new feature, so I was able to track down a couple of people who have tried it. One who I spoke to, Adnan Badawi, he said that he thinks it's a good idea. He's been giving it a shot, and he thinks that it's going to be a good option for drivers to have.
If you go 10 miles, you're paying was $9, you're paying now $10, $10.50. It's not that much difference, my friend, but it makes difference to us as a driver. I mean, I'm paying for more gas, more maintenance, more work on a car. It's a brand new car. I bought it to make the rider happy and more safe.
So there you're hearing him say, it's a small increase for for a lot of riders.
And yet, if you are doing a 10-hour shift, which you can do, and how many of those 10-mile rides you have, it's sort of that little, what they call the latte factor. Every dollar 50 adds up by the end of the day.
Exactly. So for riders, it's going to be small. But yes, for drivers, it can really add up. And at the end of the day, they might notice a difference. However, I also spoke to a woman named Kim Beaver, who said that her and her daughter, who also drives for Uber, they gave this a shot and they weren't really big fans of it.
So we set it at 1.5 for an hour, got no ride. And then she's like, well, Mom, why don't you just go on to 1.0 and I bet you get a ride. The minute I hit 1.0, boom, I got my ride. So I think it's just going to be chaos and frustrating for people. You'll be waiting an hour to 2 hours to God knows how long.
All right. That seems to indicate that you're definitely seeing the price difference there, whether you know the route or not. I know, for example, the app will show you a decrease in fare if you do a shared ride with one other person or four other people. So I haven't looked at the Uber app since this pricing has changed, but I think having the consumer know what's going on allows them to be very discerning in which ride they pick.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think that's also, you know, she said it to, you know, essentially 50% higher than what the standard rate is. And if there was a lot of other drivers out on the road and they were sticking with the base rate, then the app is going to be unlikely to connect a driver with that, with a rider. So, you know, again, it may be that it works best for smaller increments, small jumps, not maybe, you know, going 50% higher than what the base rate is. But I think Uber is willing to test this out. And, you know, they see these three airport groups of drivers as essentially guinea pigs. They're saying, let's see where this goes. Another interesting thing that's going to happen in the coming days is that Uber is going to allow drivers to lower the rate below the base rate. So they can not only raise it, but they can lower it. And I think some people are wondering, okay, is this going to be a race to the bottom where suddenly people are setting it, you know, half the rate, a third of the rate just to get rides? So it's unclear what's going to happen. And I think everyone's interested to see.
As soon as you started this story, I was thinking, oh, we're going to get into a bidding battle here in which ride you pick. And suddenly we're like online auctioning a bit. All right, I want to shift to one more topic, something that many news organizations, many government and political groups are watching for, interested citizens are paying attention. That is the state of the state message. And so far, what we know from Governor Newsom and his staff is...
We're not sure. we're still waiting on a confirmation. The governor's office hasn't said anything publicly on it. You know, unlike the budget proposal, they don't have a hard mandate as to when, you know, they have to deliver this address. So they have some flexibility on it. you know, I think that they're trying to find this window where, you know, where can the governor sort of break through, you know, these back-to-back jammed news cycles, especially with impeachment hearings, and have an opportunity to address, you know, California. And I think this is a pretty significant state of the state. I mean, they're all significant, but here we're coming after the first year of Newsom's term. You know, he had set out some pretty ambitious goals at the beginning, and he was able to achieve some of them, wasn't able to achieve others. So I think this is an opportunity for him, sort of, I guess you could say, maybe at the end of the honeymoon phase with lawmakers and the press, where, you know, he has to make the case as to, you know, highlight the things he's done, give a nod to the things he wasn't able to accomplish, and give kind of a roadmap as to how he hopes to accomplish those things.
The president's State of the Union message is scheduled for February 4th, so that's another thing taken into consideration. And I would imagine there's not enough nimbleness in a big address like this to suddenly find that there's a two-day break in the trial and here's the window when we can suddenly schedule the State of the State. That's unlikely to happen.
I agree. I mean, you know, I think the governor's office is ready to, you know, jump onto things. They've shown a quickness to react to certain things. But in terms of delivering the State of the State, yeah, I don't think it's something that can be done at the drop of a hat. You know, I should say that I have heard that it's expected to be delivered in February, perhaps mid-February. But, you know, again, that was just sort of what I've been hearing. Nothing publicly said by the governor's office yet.
All right, Scott, a lot of news lately in the world and certainly in California. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That is Scott Rodd. He is Cap Radio state government reporter. Coming up, as we continue the persistent, relentless effort by American women to earn the right to vote, I'll talk with historian and author Dr. Joanna Newman. Then at 10, you will hear NPR's special coverage of this day of the impeachment trial in the Senate. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. It is because of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution ratified on August 18, 1920, that I can vote in the upcoming California primary. I don't think I have ever been so clear about that truth. And as you know, if you're a longtime listener, I don't turn these stories around very often to make them about me, but if you, too, are a woman, to just pause and think about that is so remarkable. I can't imagine not being able to vote. But the ratification of the 19th Amendment was a finish line, and that permanent change to women's status as American citizens, it does not say a lot at that moment about the battle, but oh, what a battle it was. And earlier this week, you might have heard my conversation with Sac State historian Dr. Mona Siegel. She talked about women's surging political power 100 years ago. Today, I am thrilled to welcome Dr. Joanna Newman to Insight because she has traced 200 years of this history. Her new book is titled, And Yet They Persisted, How American Women Won the Right to Vote. Dr. Newman, so glad to have you here.
Thank you, Beth. It's a pleasure to be here.
Have you had that same kind of moment that I just described when suddenly the white light shines on this reality?
For me, the story is more, as you said, about two centuries of struggle to win the vote. Most suffrage histories begin in 1848 when Elizabeth Cady Stanton stood up at Seneca Falls, New York, and said women should have the right to vote. It was extremely controversial. Her husband boycotted the meeting for fear it would hurt his political career, and her co-sponsor, Lucretia Mott, a Quaker, said to her, Lizzie, thee will make us ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And they end their histories in 1920 when, as you said, the 19th Amendment was enacted. But when I was studying the history, I noticed that women in this country started agitating for the vote during the first flush of revolutionary fervor in the colonies. And some women, like Abigail Adams, actively fought for a voice for women. And the history goes all the way to the 1960s when African American women in the South, technically enfranchised by the 19th Amendment, but prevented from voting by Jim Crow laws that imposed draconian literacy tests and poll taxes, they went back into the streets to fight for the Voting Rights Act. So it's two centuries, eight generations, pure persistence.
Your book begins with a woman named Lydia Taft. Mm-hmm. And the very, very first story. I think you can tell it in a brief way for us, but that's a name we don't know in history, and I want people to know her name.
Lydia Chapin Taft was a widow of a very wealthy man in a town called Uxbridge, Massachusetts. And after his death, the townspeople invited her to come to town meeting and vote. She was the largest taxpayer in their town, and they knew that her funds would be needed to contribute militarily to the French and Indian Wars. She voted three times in the 1750s, and twice in the 1750s, once in the 1760s, and she is known not widely, as you said, but she is known as America's first female voter, recorded voter.
Your book contains so many stories like that, and I've heard you say that at one point you were challenged by a mentor to come up with a list of 200 women, and in this case, it was the wealthy socialites in circles perhaps in New York who were somehow involved, had an opinion, or were gathering. And that challenge to you took your research in a certain direction. Why were so many women so unknown?
You know, I think that's a wonderful question. I think the whole topic of suffrage is usually segregated in a little corner of our history. And one of my goals for this book is to reintegrate the topic into the meta-narrative of American history. So you will note in this book there are chapters in which the Civil War is a character, mm-hmm. or World War I shows up, or the Civil Rights. These are moments when our history is the nation's history.
Throughout all of this, there is a line here that sums it up, and you actually made me check some of my own writing and language on this. You write, "The guiding rule of suffrage history is that male politicians never cede power unless it advances them." And there is something to do with the language in whether women say they were granted or earned or fought for the right to vote.
Or won.
So it's worth saying something about the language we use.
And that is also a reference to fact that in the case of women's suffrage, the states served as incubators for social change, especially in California. In 1911, California voters, who were all male at the time, went to the polls and enacted a ballot initiative to give women the right to vote. It was a very tight election. The initiative won by one vote per precinct, but it had enormous dramatic effect because by 1912, 1.2 million American women could vote for president. 4 years later, many more states had enfranchised women. And it was said by analysts that Woodrow Wilson would not have been reelected without their votes. And what happens is by the time 1919, Congress is considering this amendment, women show up to lobby. They're not like Susan B. Anthony of a previous generation who was coming as a petitioner. They come as constituents. And I think that made all the difference. Mm.
1919 is a point in time that we were talking about earlier this week with the Paris Peace Treaty. But in the story you just told, if I was one of the men who cast that ballot, why wouldn't I think I gave women the right to vote? Because I voted in favor of it.
Well, you might think that, but my point is that no one cedes power unless it advantages them. So the advantage might be altruistic or philosophical, but it's calculated.
Your book is being praised and cheered. It is far and deep for a casual reader, an academic. You and I are going to carry this conversation into tomorrow, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
We will be at Sac State. There is a noon event that begins at 12:30. It's open to the public as long as space is allowed, and then we'll be in conversation and take audience questions from 1 to 2 tomorrow afternoon. But this is a continuing book event and lecture opportunity that you've given people across the country. What are you hearing back when audiences go through some of this long history? In one case, there's a story here that a 24-year-old school teacher in 1926 cast a ballot, and it would take her 31 more years to be able to continue the right to vote.
That's the shocker. Really, that's the shocker. And people are identifying with these women. They are resonating to the excavation of their lives. You know, you mentioned that I had a mentor who encouraged me to gather a spreadsheet of information about 200 of my first book. It was called Gilded Suffragists. These socialites who embraced the movement in the 1910s. And they were the media darlings of their day. They were celebrated for every excess of clothing and decor and travel. But when they embraced the movement, it was like Oprah spotlighting a cause today. Mm. It just put enormous attention on this issue that had been in the doldrums. And I think for many people reacting, the excavation, it took me 6 months to find out what I needed to find out about those 200 socialites. Sometimes all I started with in the morning was a name that wasn't theirs. It was Mrs. Husband's name. Mm-hmm. And I went through census records and newspaper accounts, obituaries, birth records. It sometimes took me a whole day, but if at the end of the day I had her first name and her maiden name, I felt like I had contributed to history. And that's what I've tried to do here too.
I want to correct what I just said, because that school teacher registered to vote in 1926. It was then 31 years later, as you write, in 1957, when she actually cast her first vote. Speaking of names, though, tell the story of Elizabeth Arden.
Oh, one of my favorite stories. Elizabeth Arden was born Florence Nightingale Graham. She was an immigrant from Canada, and she came to New York, and she wanted to open a beauty store for women.
She is, in fact, that Elizabeth
Arden. And she
Arden.
Changed her name to mm-hmm. Elizabeth Arden, yeah. And she was not very political. And she shocked her staff one day when she announced that she was leaving work at lunchtime to go march in a suffrage parade. And one of the staffers said to her, "But Miss Arden, I didn't know you were for suffrage." And she said, "Well, I'm not, but our clients are." Hmm. The other thing, when I mentioned earlier about the campaigns in the states initiatives put before what I think won eventually for suffrage was so many failures. I think sometimes we underestimate how much the import of failure to the eventual success. And so for Arden, the tide had shifted, public opinion had changed, the fangs had been diffused in this very radical issue that Elizabeth Cady Stanton had first suggested that sent her husband packing.
I'm talking with Dr. Joanna Newman. Her book is And Yet They Persisted, How American Women Won the Right to Vote. If you'd like to see us in person and hear this conversation continue tomorrow, we have posted a link at capradio.org/insight. We'll fill the room if we can tomorrow, so please join us. I had an interesting dip into your past when I found a video of you working for USA Today as a journalist interviewing President Ronald Reagan. And it seems like this was just at the very beginnings. Maybe inauguration hadn't happened yet for his second term in office.
Wow. You do good work.
You were co-interviewing with another journalist who was talking about more of the economics. And even then, you were asking him to put his presidency, his legacy, his decisions in the context of history. So tell me, in your journalism career, as a straightforward journalism, how you framed what you would do with your work and your research and your writing.
I think I had a narrator's. I always loved narrative writing. My favorite job as a journalist, though it may sound ghoulish, to learn that newspapers do advanced obituaries on famous people, mm-hmm. because you want to give import to the life of important people. And my favorite job was writing them, because they were like mini biographies. And I used to joke that writing obits was the only time in journalism that you could be kind, you know, that you could mention the falls along the road, but you could give that person the arc of their life. You could send them off. And I think that sense of narrative storytelling affected my journalism.
And just so I understand, you would write these obituaries while the person was still alive.
Yes.
Yes. And yes. So they were ready.
They were ready.
Which is a common practice.
And I did do Ronald Reagan's. I am a native of California. I'm from Los Angeles. And when the Los Angeles Times, I left USA Today for the LA Times Washington Bureau. And when the LA Times published the Reagan obituary, my mother called me and said, "Your name has never appeared so big in print." Mm-hmm. So, but it's a family heirloom as well as an archive document.
Well, I certainly hear that narrative voice in the work that you've done in your books, and you have focused a lot of it on the journey for women. Your mother or your grandmother, any of us seeing the daughter's name in print or the sister or the girlfriend's name in print, this is all still new enough that's important. It's remarkable.
You know, I dedicated this book to the four women of my past generation, my mother and my three aunts, and to the young girls of my future generation. One of them is a 3.5-year-old girl who lives in Atlanta. Her mother is my niece, and her name is Arden. And I have a picture of Arden looking at the dedication of this book. Hmm. And I look at that picture and wonder, what is she thinking? Does she know? Will she read this one day? But I do think it's a legacy that we have from the earlier generations to pass on to the next.
Dr. Newman, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, it has. Thank you.
And I look forward to much more time to be spent with you tomorrow afternoon.
I do as well. Thank you.
Dr. Joanna Newman, the book is And Yet They Persisted. You can find more at capradio.org/insight. I do want to let you know that we will continue to update the coverage of the plane crash in Australia. Three Americans were on board. There were no survivors. That will happen at capradio.org because on the air in just a few minutes, you will hear NPR's Gavel to Gavel special coverage of the impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. Thanks for listening. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Helen Barrington and Kyle McKinnon. Assistant producer is Cynthia Lopez. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today, Anthony Van Hook. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. Stay with us for much more news throughout the day and into the evening at Cap Radio. And thanks for joining us.